So with that, I think we're ready to kick things off. Again, I'm going to turn things over to Jeff Heimerman from the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation to formally begin today's session. So again, you should be looking at slide number 3, where we're going to cover the agenda for today. And again, keep your phones on mute by hitting *6. Jeff, are you ready?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much. My name, again, is Jeff Heimerman. I'm a program manager in the cleanup part of EPA, and we tend to offer these seminars mainly on cleanup topics, but on occasion we switched over to more programmatic types of presentations. And today's presentation, with special thanks to Ginger Potter and the Office of Children's Health Protection and Environmental Education, is a real opportunity for students across the country to compete for paid fellowships for this summer that's coming forward. So NEMS, which stands for the National Network of for Environmental Management Studies, is one of several fellowship programs that EPA offers throughout the years. And what we wanted to do today is have Ginger and her colleagues walk us through what the NEMS program is, what the deadlines are, how do you play in this ball game, and answer any questions that people might have. So Ginger, I thought I'd keep it short and just turn it right over to you if that's okay.
Thanks, Jeff. My name is Ginger Potter. I am with the Environmental Education Division of EPA, and I am the director of the NEMS program. So if you go to slide 3, let me run through the agenda very quickly. We're going to do a brief introduction of what EPA is and what the Office of Environmental Education does. We will talk specifically about the fellowship program, your eligibility requirements, the program coordinators, how to apply, the application package. We are going to actually spotlight a couple of recent fellowships that were in Jeff's office this past year. We'll go through the questions that come up frequently with people looking at our NEMS website, and we'll try and go through those, and hopefully that will answer most of everybody's questions. If there are any left over, then we will do a short question and answer period, and then we'll talk about the resources that NEMS offers. So if you go to slide 4, let me tell you a little bit about EPA. The Environmental Protection Agency is the federal agency that is tasked with protecting human health and the environment. We have about 17,000 employees around the country. A large percentage of them are here in Washington, D.C. at headquarters, but we have 10 regional offices, we have regional labs, and we have Office of Research and Development labs around the country. The staff at EPA is very educated, very technically trained. More than half of the staff are engineers and scientists and policy analysts. And then we also have a large number of lawyers and legal and public affairs folks, financial folks, and information management and computer specialists. This year, EPA's budget actually increased a bit, so we're now up to about $10 billion to do all we have to do to protect human health and the environment. The office that I am in, the Environmental Education Division, which is part of the Office of Children's Health Protection and Environmental Education, is responsible for the implementation of the National Environmental Education Act. Our mission is to ensure that environmental education is based on sound science and effective education practices, that it is used as a tool to promote and protect human health in the environment, and to encourage student academic achievement. The Environmental Education Division has several innovative programs and partnerships that we use to promote environmental literacy. One of our largest programs is an environmental education grant program that supports local environmental education projects that enhance the public's awareness, knowledge, and skills to help people make informed decisions. We also have the NEMS program. We also have a teacher training program that helps deliver environmental education training and supports the field of environmental education and environmental education professionals. Another program we have is the President's Environmental Youth Awards, which is targeted to students K through 12, and that is a recognition program that recognizes young people for doing local area environmental stewardship projects. So with that, I'm going to turn it over now on slide five to Carolyn.
Thanks, Ginger. As Ginger said, my name is Carolyn Patera, and I am actually a contractor for the EPA. I work with Tetra Tech EMI. On slide five, I will be providing you a synopsis of EPA's NEMS fellowship program. And then after I'm done, I'm going to pass it over to Steve Mitchner, who's going to discuss more details about the 2010 program. So let's talk about it in general, though. The NEMS program provides students with practical research opportunities and experiences in EPA's office or laboratory. It increases the public awareness of and involvement in environmental issues. It encourages individuals to pursue environmental careers. And it also helps with the costs associated with obtaining an educational degree. Those degrees are typically related to pollution control, environmental protection, science, engineering, technology, and social science. Now, our projects are separated into four categories that you see listed on slide five. The first one is environmental policy, regulation, and law, which these projects provide students an opportunity to review and evaluate existing policies and regulations, as well as conduct research related to the development of new policies. The projects may include a component that focuses on environmental compliance. The second category are projects within the environmental management and administration category. These focus on environmental management goals. The third category, environmental science. These fellowships typically involve direct participation in field studies and laboratory research. And the last category are public relations and communications. These include the review and analysis of public response to EPA policies and regulations, as well as general public opinion on environmental issues. The projects may include development of communication tools, for example, pamphlets and information materials. So let's move on to slide six, where we're going to talk about eligibility requirements for the program. NEMS fellowships are available to any associate, undergraduate, or advanced students who meet general requirements, and then we also have separate requirements based on their education level. So let's talk about the general requirements. The first one is that the applicants must be a United States citizen, its territories or its possessions, or lawfully admitted to the United States for permanent residency. The second general requirement is that applicants must be enrolled in an academic credit or for academic credit at a 2 or 4 year college or university or distance learning institution. Now, these institutions must be accredited by the Council for Higher Education Accreditation, which can be found on, they have a website at www.chea.org. So if there's any sort of question about whether an educational institution is eligible for this, they can look on that website. The last general requirement is that applicants must be pursuing an educational program that is directly related to pollution control or environmental protection for the duration of the fellowship. So those are the general requirements. Let's get a little bit more specific. If you are an associate or undergraduate student, you must have a 3.0 GPA, not a 2.999. It has to be a 3.0 GPA. And you also must have completed 4 or more courses that are related to environmental studies. If you are a graduate or a PhD student, you must be enrolled in a graduate or a PhD program. You must also have either 1 semester of that graduate or PhD program or 4 undergraduate courses completed that are related to environmental studies. All right, let's move on to slide 7, where we will be talking about timing, location, compensation, and housing during the fellowship. Most fellowships take place during the summer, starting either May or June, and going through August. However, there are some that last longer. They can last into the fall, into the winter, and potentially beyond. They also take place at various locations, as Ginger pointed out, EPA's headquarters, in their regional offices, or potentially in their laboratories. These could be located throughout all of the United States. Compensation. Students typically receive the grant award in the form of a stipend. The grant is paid in monthly installments based on the duration of the project. A portion of the stipend may be paid directly to the educational institution, or it could be paid directly to the student. That's up to the fellow. And no matching or cost-sharing is required of the fellow. Travel and housing. EPA does not pay for travel or housing, so if a fellow is awarded a fellowship that is outside of either their college area or their home area, they are responsible for making their own arrangements for travel and housing. So, I'm now turning over from slide 8 to Steve.
Yes, if you'll flip to slide 8, we'll briefly discuss the NIMS program coordinators and their role in the program. I know that several of you on the line are currently active program coordinators, but for those who are unaware, program coordinators are typically career counselors, academic advisors, science department heads, or other types of university representatives who help to promote the NIMS program at their schools. One of the primary reasons for conducting this webinar is to educate people about the NIMS program, to get more program coordinators signed up, and to encourage program coordinators and other university representatives to pass along the message about the program to students. We feel the program really isn't promoted as much as it could be at schools. It's really a tremendous opportunity for students to get experience at EPA and enhance their career pursuits. But a lot of students out there just aren't aware that it exists. So there are a variety of program materials on the NIMS website the program coordinators can use to promote the program. This includes a two-page brochure that contains background information about the program. The brochure can be downloaded and provided to students. It can be electronically distributed to students by email. It can be posted on bulletin boards and career centers. So that's one good avenue to help promote the program on campuses. And program coordinators can also help to direct students to the NIMS website so that they can learn more about the program. Aside from helping to promote the program coordinators can also assist students in the preparation and compilation of their applications if the students need that help. So just for some other general information about program coordinators, there are currently more than 250 program coordinators representing more than 200 institutions. And it's also worth noting that a student can still apply for the program even if there is not an active program coordinator at his or her school. If anybody on the line is interested in becoming a program coordinator, there's a link to register as a NIMS program coordinator from the main NIMS website. In addition, on the last slide of this presentation, there's a link for additional resources that includes a listing to sign up as a program coordinator. So please sign up if you're interested. It really only takes about a minute to complete the registration form. And if you register as a program coordinator, you will receive email updates regarding the program, such as when program materials are added to the website, as well as reminder emails about the application deadline. And program coordinators will also be listed in the NIMS catalog so that students at their universities can seek them out for assistance. Moving on to slide 9, which discusses how to apply for a 2010 fellowship. There are currently 43 projects are being offered for the 2010 program. And while a majority of the projects being offered are located in Research Triangle Oak Grove Park, North Carolina, and Washington, D.C., in Arlington, Virginia, which is right outside of D.C., there are also several projects being offered in Connecticut, New York, Philadelphia, Seattle, as well as a few other locations across the country. Students who are interested in the program can view detailed descriptions of all the projects being offered on the NIMS website. From the website, students can sort the projects based on project category, based on location, as well as the student level that is desired for the given project. If the student finds a project in which he or she is interested in applying, the student must prepare and submit a complete application package for each project in which they are interested. So we'll discuss what needs to be included in the application package on the next slide, but I'd like to point out that the application package must include an original copy of all the required application components, as well as two additional copies of all the materials. We'll talk about that a little bit more in the next slide, but Applications can be sent via email or courier, and they must be postmarked by February 5th, 2010. The main application form includes the address to which the applications should be submitted. So, all applicants will receive confirmation email notifying them of application receipt. And it's also worth noting that the program is very competitive, and historically, only about 10% of applicants have received the fellowship. So moving on to slide 10, we'll briefly discuss the components of a BIMS application package. As mentioned above, students must submit a complete application package for each project in which they are interested. So that means one original and two copies of the evaluation pack of the application package for each project in which a student is interested in applying. One of the main components of the application package is the NIMS application form. This form asks for a student's general contact information and other basic general information. On that form, the student must identify which project he or she is applying for, and it also requires the student to complete a few written sections that help to demonstrate his or her understanding of the specific project. These written sections include a proposed research plan. The proposed research plan helps to describe how the student will conduct the project, their research methodology, and it's really critical that the student really carefully consider the project activities that are described in the project description when completing this research plan. There's also a relevant information section, and in this section the student describes how his or her academic or other relevant experiences qualify him or her to conduct the project. And finally, there's an academic goals section, and this section should explain how the student expects the project to support his or her academic goals. Again, it's very important that the student give a lot of thought to the research plan and to contain the relevant information in academic goals sections. The research plan should be easy to read. It should convey the applicant's understanding of the project, and it should reinforce the applicant's ability to conduct the project. This is one of the key sections of the application package. It really helps to demonstrate why a particular applicant is uniquely qualified to conduct a project. So, other items that are required for the application package include a standard form 424, application for federal assistance. Fellowship awards are technically grant awards, and this form is required to apply for a grant with EPA. Applicants are also required to submit a current version of their resume, as well as official transcripts for each college and or university that the applicant has attended. The package should also include a NIMS reference form. This is basically similar to a standard reference letter. The reference form should be completed by an advisor or teacher who knows the student well and who can provide feedback on how the student is qualified to participate in the project. And then finally, there's a NIMS disclosure and waiver statement that must be completed and signed. All of these components of the application packs are outlined on the website, so you can go there to review that list. Again, forms can be downloaded from the NIMS website in PDF format and completed electronically if a student desires to do that. And again, the last slide of this presentation includes a link for additional resources. And from there, you can find a link to the application materials that are required. And one final note on the application packages, it's preferred that applicants include all the materials in the same application package, but in some cases it is necessary for transcripts or reference letters to be sent separately, and that's fine. In these cases, we do encourage applicants to make a note in their application indicating that, you know, certain materials are being sent separately. Moving on to slide 11. Which outlines the evaluation and selection process. The evaluation process is essentially conducted in two steps. The initial step involves a screening of the applications by external reviewers. This is done to verify the applicants are eligible for the program and that their application is complete. Eligible applications are then grouped by project number and sent to the appropriate EPA sponsoring office for official review. EPA review panels will then evaluate applications based on six criteria. Some of these criteria include relevancy of the applicant's classroom and academic experience related to the project. One of the criteria also includes the applicant's understanding of the fellowship matter. Again, this is where it's critical to prepare a well-thought-out research plan on the application form, because that's one of the places where you demonstrate that you understand the fellowship subject and can conduct the project. Review panels will also look at an applicant's leadership skills as well as their written communication skills. EPA may conduct phone interviews with some of the top-scoring applicants in order to make a final selection. And once a decision is made, EPA will contact the fellow to make a formal fellowship offer. Once the student accepts a fellowship award, the project officer will discuss with the student specific details about the fellowship. At this point, various logistics are discussed, which include the stipend amount, as well as the fellowship start and end dates. In addition, there are some additional forms that must be completed prior to the fellowship starting, and the project officer will discuss these with the student at this point as well. Applicants who are not selected are then sent a notification of non-award. Now I'll turn it over to Jeff Heimerman again, who's going to give a quick review of his office's experience with the NIMS program. So.
Jeff, just a caution before you begin. A few of the students have asked if you guys could go a little bit slower through some of the materials when you're speaking.
Thanks, Jean. And Steve, and our colleagues over in Children's Health and Environmental Education, there are a number of questions already, and I know we've got some frequently asked questions in the next set of slides coming up, so I'm not sure if you wanted to stop at this point and take a couple of them, or whether we'd prefer to go on and entertain all of them after we've been through the whole set of slides.
We can go ahead and knock some of these out if that would be helpful.
Well, why don't we try and do that, just to break it up a little bit. Deborah from Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh wants to know, does a student need an official transcript for each project that he/she might apply for?
Actually, only one official transcript is required. If you're applying for multiple projects, you just need to include one official transcript in one of those application packages. The rest can be copies for all the rest of them that are required. So just one official transcript is required in one of the application packages.
Thank you. This one, I'm not sure who it came in from, but is there any limitation on the number of projects a student can apply to? And if so, will applying to multiple projects hurt my application in any way?
No. Students can apply to as many projects as they desire. It does not hurt their chances to get in a project in a specific office. They are required to rank their order of preference for the projects on the main NIMS application form. So if they're applying to 7 projects, they will need to rank 1 through 7, the order in which they prefer to get a certain project.
Aaron at Colorado State University in Fort Collins wants to know if graduating seniors are eligible.
If a student is graduating this spring, so in the spring of 2010, they would not be eligible to apply. However, if they plan to attend graduate school in the fall, then they are eligible to apply. They just need to be able to show that they've been accepted and are enrolled in that graduate program before they will be officially awarded a fellowship.
All right, we also have one from Courtney, University of Maryland Law School, for graduate requirements, must the 4 courses / 1 semester of classes be entirely focused on environmental science or law? For example, I'm a first-year law student at the University of Maryland pursuing a degree in environmental law. I just completed my first semester, and I'm looking for environmental summer internship. The only courses I have taken so far are general requisites, non-environmental. Am I eligible?
Actually, since she's already completed one semester of upper-level courses. She did not need to meet that four courses requirement, so she would still be eligible to apply, yes.
Okay. And actually, I had one which gets back to eligibility requirements, and I think it was back on slide six, where the last entry under general eligibility requirements says pursuing an environmental protection degree. Is that indeed the case? So an economics major, chemistry major, others would be ineligible?
Not necessarily. As long as the student has taken, four courses related to the field of environmental studies, and that's a pretty loose definition there. We include general chemistry, biology, physics, general science courses do qualify as environmental studies courses in this definition. Yes, as well as engineering. So as long as a student feels that they are qualified for the project, that they can meet the project requirements, and that they have taken, four general science or engineering courses, then they would still be eligible to apply.
Great. And I think there are a number of questions that are kind of along that same lines that are in the queue already. Let me ask another one. Heather from the University of Washington in Seattle. If students are pursuing a Master of Public Administration but with a focus on environmental policy and will have several courses related to environmental policy issues, would this be applicable to the requirements that the students be pursuing an environmental science degree? I think you might have answered that.
Yes, certainly. She would be eligible, yes.
Okay. And, let me see what else. Ray from Indiana University, is email submission of the application packet a possibility?
Various components could be submitted by email, but we're really looking for a hard copy submission of the application because, we need official copies of the transcripts. We need a signed reference letter. We need a hand-signed disclosure and waiver statement. All those materials need to be submitted in hard copy. So
it's a case-specific situation, right?
No.
They should all be submitted in hard copy. Now, if a applicant forgets to send their resume, they could follow up and send that via email, but we prefer that everything be included in one package and all sent together in hard copy format.
And Jeff, the issue is that many of these require original signatures. That is a requirement from our grants administration division, so we can't get around that.
Well, thank you for clarifying that. if we've got a little bit more time, Heather from the University of Washington in Seattle, does participation in the fellowship count as a student career experience program, which could then allow students to be converted to full-time employees?
No.
I don't think it
does. No, I'm not sure what the student career development or experience program is, but no, the fellowship program would not.
That would be my understanding as well. Let me take one more here. This comes from Karen, University of Chicago. I'm currently a master's student at the University of Chicago, live in Chicago. Is it a requirement that a fellow need to live in the same city as the project location throughout the entire duration of the project? For example, if I receive a fellowship in RTP that overlapped with a part of the school year, would it be possible to work on the project remotely from Chicago for a portion of the project?
This really comes down to a project-by-project basis, and it's up to the project sponsor for that given project as to whether or not they will, what they want worked out. At the end of the presentation, there will be a contact email address for Carolyn Patera. I would suggest that Karen sent a follow-up email to Carolyn. so that she can get in touch with the project officer and see what type of arrangement could be worked out. Oftentimes, if a fellowship extends for more than just the summer period, the project officer will allow students to work remotely part-time during the, you know, part of the fellowship that extends into the school year. But again, that needs to be determined based on what the project sponsor is looking for. So we will need to... we'll need to follow up with the specific project officer for the project that she's looking at applying for.
All right, thank you very much. There's one more that's asking about if you could please repeat the 6 evaluation criteria. I don't know if you would mind going through that.
Yeah, let me, I don't have them all right here in front of me. I'm just going to pop open this. Okay, the 6 evaluation criteria, they are listed in the NIMS catalog on page 8, which is available for download on the NIMS website. But I will go ahead and read them off. First one is relevancy of the classroom experience of the student as it relates to the ETA fellowship. The second one is the student's understanding of the proposed ETA fellowship subject matter. The third one is the relevancy of work experience of the student, and that can be determined based on volunteer activities, internships, or other paid jobs, and the relevancy of this work experience as it relates to the EPA fellowship. The fourth criteria is the relevancy of the student's academic studies. The fifth criteria is the leadership skills, written communication skills, and demonstrating success at working well in an office, laboratory, or field environment as appropriate to the project. And the last one is the student's potential for success as reflected by academic records, letters of reference, and other relevant information.
But again, as you noted, all of these are in the project catalog.
Page 8.
Loaded from the NIMS website. And as Gene mentioned at the beginning of this seminar, there is a links page associated with this specific seminar. We'll go through it at the end of it. But all of these items are directly linked via this seminar. And when we archive this with the audio within a week, that set of links will be attached to this seminar. So you'll be able to go back and check that out. The questions that came in my neglect, I forgot to open the questioning up to the phone lines. And so can we just do one quick check-in with the participants on the phone? If you have a question at this point, take your phone off of mute. Please tell us who you are and where you're calling from and ask the question.
And if you've used our local mute button, the command of *6, you simply hit #6 to unmute your lines now.
So if anybody has them, now's the time to ask them. Hearing none, I think it might be a good time to move on through the rest of the presentation. And maybe some of the frequently asked questions will be answered when we go through the rest of the slides. Plus, we'll open it up for questions and answers at the end of this again. Right now you should be on slide 12. And just as a little bit of background, Ginger works in one office, the National Children's Health and Environmental Education Division, and we work in the Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response. We would be one of the programs that would be sponsoring specific projects while the Environmental Education Office runs the whole program. So I want to turn it over to one of my colleagues, Carlos Pachon, and have him talk about some of the recent fellowships that our particular office has sponsored over the years. Carlos, are you available?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Hi, everybody. So on the current slide, what we have is the bottom three bullets are the titles of some of the research topics that we put projects out for over the last, since 1997 actually. We've been hosting them, students, and over that time we have received, we have sponsored about 71 interns and fellows. I believe the number of fellows is around 35. NEMS fellows out of those 71 interns and fellows. So a significant part of the people we have here over the summer come from the NEMS program. And they focus on a series of topics mostly related to our mission, which is advancing best practices in contaminated site cleanup. So you can see three of the titles there, of the papers that were produced. And at the bottom of the page is a URL for all the papers that our interns and fellows produce. We have them all co-located, make them easy to find, and that's the URL. So if you have an interest in seeing what other students, both undergrad and grad, have been able to produce during their time here with us, feel free to explore that URL. Not all students produce the paper, and we'll come to that in a second. So if we can move on to slide 13, please. I'd like to describe the process internal on our side as an office that receives applications and sponsors fellows. This is a short description of the process that we go through here. And for each fellow, it starts about 12 months in advance. So sometime around May or June, we'll get together and discuss what our priorities are for the year, what current issues and challenges we've identified are out there, and develop some project proposals. Sometimes those proposals do carry over for a year or two because, of course, they tend to be pretty large topics that can't be resolved in a short period of time. So we submit those, and that's what you've seen, those two project proposals, project areas that have been submitted for 2010, and we'll see those in the next slide. One thing I want to point out is that we here in this office, in particular in this office, we have important resources for what's called extramural support. So we have access to top-notch professionals in the consulting sector. So that's what we're looking for here. Often is some creativity and opportunity to interact with somebody who's ambitious and has an open mind to help to explore a problem and work on it. We're not looking for people to be in a production mode when we for the folks that we have here. So we put that out there, and then we receive the proposals, which I guess we'll start receiving them in March, I believe, is more or less when we receive the proposals for the research proposals for those projects. So about 3 months in advance of the person arriving. So we get together, we hand them out, or we spread them out depending on who the sponsor is for a specific project area, and we'll review these. And as Steve mentioned earlier, it is quite competitive. I think last year we had about 20 applications. So I have to admit it is quite competitive, and we have to thank the career counselors at the universities for directing qualified students in our direction. That's much appreciated, and it's obvious that really the quality of the applications is quite good. I did want to point out one thing. While we have two projects out there, we may take more than two fellows. So that depends a little bit on the budget. There's always some flexibility, how certain monies are being allocated, etc. And if we see highly qualified applicants that have really good research proposals, we may take more than one for each of the project areas. That has happened in the past. So once fellows arrive, at least this is my experience, I've mentored about six or seven fellows over the last few years. I like to hit the ground running with them and make them, first thing is raise awareness that it's not, you don't have all summer. You have 3 months and time flies by. So from the get-go, we start, learning, getting them to learn who we are, who our office is, who works here, what types of issues we work on, so we can start defining the scope of the project that they're going to be involved in. Because while they did read the project area and they did submit a proposal, that's still generally very broad, very light. So it's important to spend the first couple of weeks defining what they're going to be working on and what that's going to look like. And then one of the areas that we try to encourage is that they be ambitious, that they think out of the box, that they make they connect the dots, etc. But that they be realistic, because it is 3 months with limited resources, and we do like to have a final product when they are done. And we think that's really important for them, as you'll see, because we get a lot of mileage out of the products, and we hope they do too, both professionally and short term and long term. So while they are here, there's ample support provided. They're one more employee, basically, in the office. They've got their workspace, their laptop, which they can take with them when they're, you know, on weekends and stuff, phone, workspace. We facilitate networking with subject matter experts on the topic they're working on. So we'll set up conference calls, introduce them to people in our office or in other offices. Set up, just an informational interview so they can get raise the level of awareness. I think that's very important, so they know who it is that they'll be working with. We also provide access to lots of the training that we have internally, and then we help them meet senior program management early on, because later on often they will be briefing some of our senior management division directors, etc. So all that is both part of their professional development, but it's also part of their, getting to know the program, so the product that they come out with is of more value to us as well. Towards the end of the fellowship, well, we do have check-in periods, we call them midterm evaluations, if you like. The mentor will meet with them periodically, and halfway through, we do have some milestones. I personally like to establish some milestones so we know what direction we're headed in, such as a draft outline, annotated outline, an interim briefing for subject matter experts on the research proposal once it's been developed a little bit further. And then in the closeout, we strongly encourage them to have an internet seminar such as this one. And the final product, it generally varies, but often it is a paper that we will for those that do meet a certain criteria, we will put it through a professional technical writer, editor, et cetera, with final review from the fellow. We will publish it. We will publish that final report. So let's look at a specific example. We can go to slide 14. This is one student that we had last year. I'm sorry, these are the two topic areas. Sorry, I jumped ahead here. These are the two topic areas that we have for this year. The first is the use of innovative treatment technologies to address dense non-aqueous phase liquids at Superfund sites. And the second is green remediation practices to reduce the environmental footprint of contaminated site remediation projects. And this is actually the third year that we have this topic out there, because it's an area of growing interest, and it's growing broader and broader, so there's still quite a bit of work to be done in this area. So in writing these proposals, of course, as I mentioned earlier, our focus is on projects that advance our mission, but while also providing a significant professional experience for the fellows. If you've read some of these project proposals, you'll notice that they're generally pretty open-ended. We're not asking for, this is not a scope of work for a contractor to do something. They're generally pretty open-ended. Creativity is invited, is welcome, and we invite creativity in writing the application, and we look closely at the research proposals. We recognize that some of these topics are new, even for us, and the fellows have, or the students have, relatively little information. They don't know what we're expecting, but it is clear when there's a good research framework, when somebody lays out, this is going to be my approach, without having to go into the details of exactly what they're going to do. Of course, we look for knowledge of the subject matter, either through coursework, previous work experience, or other indicators of knowledge in the subject matter. And we look for people that are building bridges across disciplines. That's often, a technical issue will have an important policy or scientific angle to it, or vice versa. So we look for people that can build those bridges. The types of projects, generally, they can be qualified as advancing concepts and frameworks, or exploring and documenting technical issues. And I think the two project proposals that you have out there cover those two areas. And then once the student arrives, as I was suggesting earlier, our expectations of what they can produce, of course, are commensurate with the student's level of experience. So we won't expect the same from a graduate student than we would from a sophomore. So let's go to slide 15 here. Is it 15 or 16?
15.
15. Thank you. Slide 15. And this is what I was one mentioned earlier, just before. Fellow's experience, from my point of view, of course. This is Gabriel Sampson. He's the last NEMS fellow that I mentored. He was here last summer. He's a first-year master's student at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And his application was on the topic of green remediation, and he originally proposed to develop a quantitative method for evaluating environmental footprints, and that was right in line with the type of work that we're doing here. But after speaking with him over the first 2 weeks and trying to gauge how much work that would take and the work that we had already undertaken, we agreed that that might be too ambitious, so either he'd write a very shallow report or he'd dive very deep into a narrow component of that. So after two or three weeks of exploring, kicking ideas around, we decided to focus on something else, something that we knew was a current issue, technical issue related to sustainability and site cleanup and reuse, and that is challenges that people were facing on making good use of closed landfills. Closed landfills is a significant surface area that has very limited uses, yet there's good opportunity to place different types of solar energy on it to make good use of that space. So we refined the topic to solar power installations on closed landfills, technical and regulatory considerations. At the end of his project, he did produce a draft report after 8 weeks. We had a large conference call with quite a few people where he laid that out, what his approach was, and got good information from different, for example, the Air Force has quite a few landfills on their bases, consulting engineering firms that build landfills, municipalities. There are quite a few people on that first call that gave him excellent feedback. And he produced the draft, a final report, for which we had a full open internet seminar, similar to this one, with open registration. And he had over 200 people participate in that one. I think it was a great professional experience for him. It was a great product. We definitely liked the report. Had a professional technical writers edit the report. We had approved. We went through two more revisions. He was already back at the University of California. And it was released, I think, in November of 2009 and sent out through TechDirect, which is our newsletter, which went out to over 40,000 subscribers. So I hope that gives you some insight of, you know, how things, what happens here, what our points of view are, and what our experience is with the fellow. I'll be glad to take questions now or at the end.
Why don't we hold them to the end, because we're going to just jump right into frequently asked questions. Everyone should be turning to slide 16, and I'd like to turn it back to Steve. I'm not sure. Can't remember.
I'm going to take over, Carolyn.
Thank you, Carolyn.
All right, well, because we took that good break and talked about some of the questions, we don't necessarily need to go over them, but let me touch on slide 16. The second one is in relation to who is eligible for a fellowship or to apply for this. And NEMS is only available to students who are U.S. citizens. So international students, unfortunately, are not applicable for this program. And the third point is asking about the deadline.
If an international student has a green card, then they are eligible.
Okay. Well, and that's also, all the details are also included in the catalog, so if there's any question about that, it's referenced there, and they can also submit a question on specific details for each situation. Looking at the deadline, applications must be postmarked by the deadline, which is February 5th. It doesn't mean they necessarily have to be received by that date, but they must be postmarked. Anything after that date will not be eligible.
But we're not encouraging procrastination.
No. The earlier the better.
Remember, we're talking to college kids.
Let's move on to slide 17. We've already talked about sending everything separately. We'd like it all together if possible, but that sometimes happens. It needs to come separately. Project descriptions can sometimes be a little bit confusing, or maybe an applicant may have a little bit more questions on it. So an applicant can submit a project-specific question by going to the NEMS website, and there's a link to submit a project-specific question. That question will then be forwarded on to the project officer and then provided back to the applicant as soon as possible. So if there's something that needs to be a little bit more information obtained for, that can be done in that manner. And then Steve went over about sending applications, but they can all be sent within the same package. So if you're applying for four different projects, it does not mean that they have to be in four separate envelopes or packages. They can all come together. Our last slide of frequently asked questions is slide 18. Steve went over the transcripts. But in regards to everybody applying and wanting to know when they actually are accepted or not accepted for the fellowship program, most applicants are notified of their acceptance in either April or May, and those will come by email. If applicants aren't notified within 30 days of their application, they can, again, go to the NEMS website and send an email, and we can straighten everything out in terms of their questions. And those are all the frequently asked questions that we wanted to address. I just wanted to point out, I think Tyler at Duke University had asked a question about his transcript, which he said, are we allowed to have university send transcripts directly to us so that we can open and copy their transcripts to put the application packages, or do they have to be sealed from the university? And the answer to that is that transcripts can go to the applicant, and they can open that because obviously they need to make copies. But we do ask that the original envelope that the transcript came in be included in the application package.
Just as a clarification to that, let me ask a follow-on question. In the instance where somebody doesn't, how do I say this, that they submit two separate project proposals, not in the same envelope, then they run into a problem. Is that not correct?
Basically, even if application packages are sent separately, we combine them all and review them together. So as long as there's one original transcript in one of those packages, that's all we need.
And one envelope if it was opened.
Correct. Okay. The rest can be copies.
All right. We're really towards the end of this right now. If you go to slide 19, we'll just open it up again for questions and answers. And there aren't a lot of questions so far on the simulcast, so why don't I turn it around this time and open it up to the folks on the phone. Again, if you want to ask a question, I think you're hitting #6 to get off of mute. And please identify who you are and where you're calling from. So this is now's a perfect time while we have the experts online with us to pose questions that we have. Anyone? Not the time to be bashful.
Jeff, I will note that the website contains a pretty comprehensive list of frequently asked questions, some of the ones we've already discussed today. There are also a lot that we didn't hit on today, so if applicants do come up with questions at a later date, they can check that out on the website, or they can, fill out the contact us, form as well to get questions to us if they have them at a later date, so.
Well, there are two questions, from Gene and one from me. So I'll ask from Gene about Is the funding split equally between the four types of fellows? There really aren't four types of fellows, they're four types of projects. Or is more available in one category than the others? Have you looked at any of that?
Yeah, based on this year, there's 18 projects available for environmental policy, regulation, and law. That's the most. Public relations and communications has 3 projects. If you go to the NIMS catalog, all the project descriptions are broken out by project category. So they definitely vary the number of projects that are offered per category.
Catherine from the University of Delaware asks, can you give some examples of a proposed research plan?
We do have a sample completed application form in the NIMS catalog. So if you download that catalog and go to the one of the appendices that contains all the application forms, there will be a sample completed application form that contains a example of a proposed research plan.
All right, anybody else, either simulcast or one more time on the phone? We've really got a bashful phone audience today. Usually there's at least a few questions that come in over the phone line, so I want to open it up again. Anyone on the phone lines, if you have a question, now would be a perfect time to ask it. This must have been crystal clear for everyone. I do have, a number of questions just came in over the simulcast. Kelsey from the University of Minnesota, please provide details about what should be included in the proposed research plan.
The proposed research plan is really, trying to outline how a student will go about and conduct the research on the given project. So it's pretty critical that the student review carefully the project description and have a good understanding of the work that's trying to be done and the research that needs to be conducted. And then a well thought out research plan, how they're going to conduct the research that's outlined in the project. It doesn't need to be, 2 pages long or anything, but there should definitely be a couple or a few paragraphs of, detailed information that really conveys that they understand the project and that they're capable of completing the work that's in the project.
And let me also add, there is a difference for a project that's looking for a graduate student and a project that's looking for an undergraduate student. The expectation for the graduate student is that it would be much more detailed and would be much more referenced than one for a sophomore or a junior trying to write a research plan for a project.
We have another anonymous question. If anything is missing from my application, will NIMS contact me for the missing items, or will I be automatically rejected?
NIMS staff will contact applicants if they are missing items from their applications. And then they will have a short period of time to submit that information. If that information is not submitted, the application is still sent over to EPA. However, there's a big note on it indicating that, X, Y, and Z items are missing, and, that counts as a big negative. So we definitely encourage students to make sure they include everything in their applications.
One last chance for the folks on the phone. Anybody, if you have a question, just take your phone off of mute, tell us who you are and where you're calling from. Hearing none, I'd like to ask one last question, and it isn't directly related to today's topic of NIMS, but it may be relevant because we have a lot of university representatives on the line with us. And I was trying to just, it was on, I think it was slide 4, there was mention of environmental education grants. Are those open to applications from universities, you know, so that university itself could sponsor some sort of project or grant application?
Okay. There is a separation of the NEMS program and the Environmental Education Grant Program. The grant program is for organizations, education and government organizations, nonprofit organizations, to submit a proposal to the EE grant program. That has nothing to do with the NEMS program.
In fact, I understand that.
Okay.
Kelsey.
Can universities apply for the grant program? Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Since it was mentioned on the slide, I thought I'd at least bring it up as another potential opportunity for universities outside of this whole discussion that we've had today. Kelsey from University of Minnesota. What qualities/experiences about a student and proposed research plan are especially important to emphasize? What stands out to the reviewers?
I think that varies depending on the project. I mean, each individual sponsoring office reviews their own application, so that probably varies depending on the sponsoring office. But, you know, Carlos or Jeff, do you have any specific input that would provide a little guidance there?
Carlos, you on?
Carlos actually was just pulled away outside of the office, so he's not in the room right now.
In short, I think we're looking to see whether the individual's got a strong academic record. We're looking to see that the individual understands what we're asking in the project proposal, project description, and proposes a way of exploring and completing a project in an amount of time. So some of that is research skills, you know, literature research skills. Some of it is knowledge of the topic. Some of it is, you know, some indication of adaptability, flexibility, and creativity. Unfortunately, luckily, or unfortunately, one of the two, I'm not usually a part of the review process when we're selecting candidates. That's being done at the staff level. Well, I don't think there are any more questions. Another one just popped up as I said that. Is there any help offered to find lodging for fellowship? I understand that no funding is given, but there are other means to assist a fellow if they have problems finding affordable housing. You know, I might be able to speak to this from our past experience, both with NIMS fellows and with other internships as they come to D.C. at least. And the answer is yes, we usually try and help them identify different opportunities. A number of the universities that are local here, you know, have vacant housing and housing for rent during the summer. So that seems to be typically where most of our interns end up turning to one of the local universities and a dorm room for rent for the summer. Not sure if other program offices do it differently, but I think that's mainly what we do. I don't think there are any other questions, so why don't we move ahead to slide 20.
Actually, Jeff, there was one last one if you want to squeeze it in while we have a few minutes.
Funny, because every time I click it off, another one pops up.
I think we really will make this one the final one, and this one's coming in from Mason at the University of Maine, and he asks, how are topics selected for the research? He's more specifically, he's surprised to see that a topic of life cycle assessment is not a research option. Should we expect to see new research topics arise each year?
And I think I can help answer that question because Ginger's group solicits the topics for projects from program offices and the research offices like ours. So we are the ones putting forward, you know, one or two, possibly three or four topics each summer. So, you know, there may be a lot of other work that we're actually doing in the area of life cycle assessment, for example, that is ongoing in our normal body of work, and that's just not one that we've included in the catalog of projects. Ginger, I don't know if you want to speak more about that.
No, you pretty much said it, Jeff. It's a matter of what the agency is working on, what program managers or scientists are looking for at that time. So, yes, every year you will get different projects. You may get some projects the same, but most of them are different year to year.
Thank you, Ginger. Why don't we go to slide 20, which gives you a snapshot of the NIMS homepage on EPA.gov. You don't have to write these URLs down because we're going to go on to the links, and I'd like to turn it over to Jean and have her walk us and finish up the seminar. Jean?
Great, thanks, Jeff. As you mentioned, if we could push everyone on to the very final slide number 21, which has the two references or links that we mentioned at the start of today's presentation. The first one is the additional resources page, which you'll also be able to find at the very bottom of the seminar homepage. You'll see something that says links to additional resources. It's an active hyperlink on slide 21 if you're looking at it electronically. And if you click on that, that'll bring you to a listing of not only today's PowerPoint presentation to download, but a series of other websites and reports and documents that were either discussed or are relevant to today's topic. You can also have the opportunity to sign up for more information about future seminars like this, as well as be notified as soon as our latest archive training sessions are available to download. So we do highly recommend that you take in a minute or two and refer back to the additional resources page. The second link on slide number 21 is a link to the feedback form for this session. It's a really short, simple form, and I do ask that you take just a minute or two to complete this seminar feedback form so that we can take a look at your comments and use it to improve and continue deliveries for information sessions like this. This is one of the first times NEMS has offered an online outreach session to kind of talk about the solicitation this year, and hopefully with your comments, they'll continue to take advantage of this type of an outreach opportunity and do this for future solicitations. I will personally read each and every one of your comments, and I do appreciate any time that you could take to fill that out. If you are at a location where you're sharing the line with multiple people, there's an option that once you submit feedback, there's an immediate link that pops up that someone else can fill out the form there with you. So you can have multiple people submit the feedback form. And if each of you need confirmation, again, there's a simple box to check when you're filling out that form at the top to let us know, and we'll shoot off an automated email to confirm your participation today for your records. So that's the final slide in today's presentation. Again, I want to thank not only the organizers, the presenters, but also all of the attendees and individuals who helped spread the word about today's seminar. This is a final reminder that this entire event was recorded and will be archived. We expect to have it up towards the end of next week. You'll be able to download it for free at the CLUIN archive page at cluin.org/live/archive. And you'll either be able to download the PowerPoint with audio or actually go into our iTunes podcast and get the latest training as soon as available, including the slides and the MP3 audio transcript. So, again, thank you to everyone who was able to join us today. I do hope we'll see you again on a future seminar.
Before we leave, though, I just want to take one last opportunity to thank Ginger Potter and Steve and Caroline for presenting, as well as for Carlos. And I think the last thing we want to leave people with is a reminder that the deadline for the 2010 program solicitation proposals is February 5th, 2010. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
And Jeff, thank you and Jean and Carlos for taking time and putting this all together. It was a good idea for us to do this and get more information out to the universities, and we really appreciate your help in doing that.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you. This will conclude the Internet Seminar Forum. Have a great afternoon. Good morning, everyone.